WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Writer Joyce Johnson met Jack Kerouac in 1957 through their mutual friend Allen Ginsberg. Johnson and Kerouac were lovers for nearly 2 years. When they met, Johnson was 21 years old. Kerouac was 35 and not yet famous. But while they were together, his novel On the Road was published, and he was transformed into the spokesperson of the Beats. Much of the time that Johnson and Kerouac were lovers, he was traveling or living in another city while she stayed in Manhattan. During those times, they communicated through letters. The letters they wrote each other are published in Johnson's book, Door Wide Open, which has just been published in paperback. Johnson is also the author of an earlier memoir called Minor Characters, focusing on the period when she knew Kerouac. But she couldn't quote from his letters in that book because Kerouac's widow withheld permission. And it wasn't until 1998 that his estate sent her copies of the letters she had written to him. Last year, when Door Wide Open was published in hardcover, I asked Johnson what first attracted her to Kerouac.
He was the most unusual person I'd ever met. He had an incredible memory. He told great stories. He'd had amazing adventures. And he had a kind of sweetness and melancholy about him that were also very, very appealing. And an ability to take a lot of pleasure in small everyday things. You know, if I made him a bowl of Lipton's pea soup, I was a great cook. He totally charmed me when I met him.
Now you met him through Allen Ginsberg, and shortly after you met, he was off on his travels again. And
yeah.
One of the early letters in your book is when he sent you from Tangiers, and I'd like you to read an excerpt of it.
Sure. This was in early March 1957. He wrote it just as he was nearing the coast of Africa. He'd been on a freighter called the SS Slovenia for about a month. All during the trip, I ate alone at a huge white tablecloth with one mysterious Yugoslavian woman, Mata Hari. We had a dangerous storm 500 miles out and almost foundered. In all my years as a seaman, I never saw my ship bury its nose in mountain waves and plunge up into other valleys like a rowboat. It was awful. We had to flee south and lose a day. During this ordeal, I heard the words, "Everything is God. Nothing ever happened except God." And I believed and still do. Kierkegaard and the storm together made me see this luminous, peaceful truth.
Now, I found your response to his letter so interesting because here he is, you know, traveling around the world, having these, like, grand adventures, and you're, you know, working in New York and trying to deal with, like, your life versus his life and how different they seemed. Read us an excerpt of your response to him.
Okay. I've thought a lot about your letter, about your finding God in the middle of the storm. I can't really comprehend that. I want you to know that about me. I scramble from day to day, hour to hour, and I seldom stop to ask questions, because when I do, I find everything in the world senseless, without reason, and it terrifies me. I'm not defending myself. I'm simply telling you this. I look at your way with wonder, but there's nothing I can say to you about it except that. And in the meanwhile, I move 2 miles downtown to a new job, not too different from the old one, and you move across the ocean to another continent.
In a way, while he's having this big adventure, you know, going to Northern Africa, your adventure is in part being with him, knowing him.
Absolutely. That was a big adventure for me. But also my adventure, as it turned out, was also being in New York in that whole wonderful period and discovering all these very, very gifted people who are all converging on downtown Manhattan, painters, poets, photographers, actors. It was sort of an amazing scene. It was a very, very good time to be in New York.
You know, although Kerouac sounds really excited and invigorated in the first letter he sends you, his letters start to sound more depressed not long after that. Let me ask you to read an excerpt of this March 1957 letter.
There are many dull expatriate characters here I try to avoid mostly. Not too many good vibrations in Tangier. And the Arabs, very quiet, send out no vibrations at all. So I spend most of my time musing in my room. Somehow can't write here, but anyway, that can wait. What I'm actually doing is thinking nostalgic thoughts of Frisco. Not too interested in this old world scene, as though I'd seen it before plenty. Anyway, in early April, I'm off by myself to Paris. The others can join me later to get cheap garret, then London, Dublin, Brittany. Then I try to get job on freighter, work my way back this summer. I just don't seem interested. Got too much to do in America. Shouldn't have come at all, of course. So I'll likely be seeing you in New York, in July, maybe. Look forward to seeing you. Lonely here. Don't like whores anyway, and no girls speak English. Mostly fags abound in this sinister international hive of queens. I've had everything in the books, smoked opium, ate hashish. Don't want any of it. Just musing in my room. Lights out, face sea, moon, liquid lights of anchored ships and bay. Good enough.
How did it make you feel to have him complaining about the whores?
Well, it certainly made me feel weird. It was as though he'd forgotten that I was his girlfriend, you know, and it sounded as though he was writing to one of his buddies. I didn't know what to make of it.
Were you surprised that he was in this place that he'd worked so hard to get to, and he didn't like being there, and he was saying maybe he shouldn't have come at all, and he was telling you all these other places he's going to go to, and sounding very depressed?
Well, I was surprised because he had really been looking forward to this trip immensely and planned to spend many months in Tangier and then spend a good part of the next year traveling in Europe. But I soon learned that this was sort of a pattern of Jack's. You know, he would before he went to a place, he would fantasize about it and think that it was going to be wonderful and the solution to all his problems, and then he'd get there and inevitably the bad vibrations would set in because wherever he went, he took his troubles with him, and I think by that time in his life, there was no place in the world where he could really be happy or comfortable. Nothing worked for him.
In the letters, he always seems to be want to be in the place that he wasn't.
That's right, to see something new and strange.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how that affected you. For instance, I mean, he'd invite you to come and be with him in San Francisco, and then he'd write and tell you he was leaving for Mexico. He'd invite you to Mexico, and then he'd decide, no, he had to go to New York. And so you were always having to change your plans.
Well, it certainly complicated my life immensely, and it was very disappointing because I wanted so much to travel myself. And I also, you know, had to take steps in order to prepare myself to travel, such as giving up my job or saving money or giving up my apartment. So I had a very complicated summer, the summer of 1957, when I was thinking first that I would join Jack in San Francisco and then later in Mexico City. I was particularly disappointed about not going to Mexico City. He had gotten the Asiatic flu in Mexico City and was going back to Orlando, Florida, and from there he planned to come to New York in time for the publication of On the Road. He thought it might be kind of interesting to be around for it.
And
he
had
absolutely no notion of what awaited him.
Right. Well, he was around for it. In fact, he was staying with you at your apartment the day
right.
that famous review by Gilbert Milstein came out in the New York Times. Would you describe what it was like to go with him at midnight to the newsstand and pick up this review that basically made him a star overnight?
Well, it was nothing that Jack was prepared for. I mean, he could barely sort of take it in. It compared him in his importance to F. Scott Fitzgerald. Milstein said what Fitzgerald was to the Lost Generation, Kerouac would be to the Beat Generation, and he was made him the spokesman for a whole generation. He kept reading it and sort of shaking his head and saying, "Well, I think it's pretty good. What do you think?" And I say, "Yeah, it's really good." And then the next day, the phone started ringing and never stopped.
Not all the reviews were positive, like Truman Capote.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, describe some of the bad reviews.
Well, I would say by and large, the reviews On the Road got were hostile, humiliating, and very insulting things were said about On the Road. For example, Truman Capote said, "This isn't writing, this is typing." I mean, I can't think of any American writer who endured such consistent abuse from critics and reviewers all through his career. And it was very, very devastating for him.
How did he take the bad reviews?
They made him very depressed. Of course, he had a tendency to be depressed. And the only way he seemed to be able to get himself through this period was to step up his drinking, which was already pretty heavy.
Soon after that review in the New York Times, he left New York. And soon after he left, you wrote a letter to your friend Elise, and I'd like you to excerpt that letter.
I dig ironing his shirts, cooking for him, etc. It's funny. It's not at all romantic anymore, but it doesn't matter. I love him. Don't mind playing mama, since that's what he seems to want me to be. I may go down to see him in Orlando. I've gotten kind of a left-handed backwards invitation. His mother seems to want me to come. There's no doubt in my mind anymore that mama is the villain in the true classic Freudian sense.
Now, when you said it's not that romantic anymore, what did you mean?
I found myself in the position of almost having to take care of Jack to kind of get him through this whole experience that he was coping with so badly. And it was a very unfamiliar role for me. I was only 21. But I thought, you know, he would get through the difficulties of this period and come out of it. But that's really not what happened.
How did you feel being in this really unconventional relationship, yet expected to do very conventional things for Kerouac, like cooking and ironing and taking him home when he got too drunk?
Well, you know, everything seemed so crazy. We were living such a strange life that it was almost a relief to iron a shirt. It was sort of quiet and familiar, you know? Everything that was sort of quiet and familiar and home-like had gotten to seem sort of exotic to me because the life we were living was so strange.
Now, in this letter that you just read an excerpt of, you said that there's no doubt that his mother is the villain in the true classic Freudian sense.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that?
It became apparent to me that Jack really had not separated from his mother. He was overly attached to his mother. You know, he planned to settle down and live with her, which was something that was very hard for me to understand, that she had too much of a hold on him for his own good.
Was it her trying to have a hold on him, or was it him wanting to be with her?
It worked both ways. I mean, she wanted to keep him with her, and so that any young woman who came into his life was considered the enemy, someone who had to be fended off or driven off. At the same time, she had always been a source of refuge for him during those years when he was very broke and obscure and wandering around the United States and virtually homeless. She provided a base for him, a place where he could come and crash and write another book and keep his manuscripts and his letters. So I think without his Jack's mother, we might have had fewer Kerouac novels. She was important to him in that way, in a good way, but her emotional hold on him was very crippling for Jack.
My guest is Joyce Johnson. Her book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters she and Jack Kerouac wrote each other. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joyce Johnson. Her book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters she and Jack Kerouac wrote each other during the 2 years they were lovers. How did fame agree with him?
Fame did not agree with him very well at all. Part of the problem was he didn't become famous in the way that he would have liked to have become famous. I think what he really had dreamed of was having a real, you know, a literary success, which would have been much quieter, for one thing. But instead of that, he found himself the spokesperson for the Beat Generation, and this was not a role that he felt at all comfortable with. It was something Allen Ginsberg, of course, could have played to the hilt. But Jack was not very, very good at facing the public. He was basically a shy, rather naive guy about the whole business, and it was very difficult for him being on television and so on. It was frightening for him, and it made him feel that he didn't know who he was anymore.
Now, you say that after he became famous, there was a pack of predatory women that invaded your lives. What was it like watching all of these women flirting with Jack Kerouac?
Oh, of course, I hated it, and it made me furious. And it was as though I you know, I didn't exist at all. Suddenly there was this swarm of women around him. He was such a celebrity and so attractive. And, you know, right in front of me, these women were throwing themselves at Jack. It was very unpleasant to watch.
You say that during this period, everyone wanted to, like, give him pills or buy him drinks. He already had a drinking problem. Did it get worse?
It did get much worse. And, you know, I think he felt that he had to live up to an image of himself that people had, that they didn't really expect to see someone like Jack Kerouac, who was a fairly quiet guy, kind of an observer. They expected to see someone very extroverted, like the Dean Moriarty character in his novel. So the only way he could approximate that character was to get very loaded.
And did he become more like Dean Moriarty when he did become loaded?
He became much, much more extroverted and outgoing, mm-hmm. and talked more.
Now, you said that you grew up in a house without any alcohol, with the exception of Menashevitz Passover wine.
Right.
Were there things you didn't understand about his drinking?
Yeah, I really didn't understand about his drinking. I thought that, if Jack's could just sort of get through this period and settle down and maybe have a real home somewhere, he could sort of straighten himself out. And he kept wanting to stop drinking, and he would make attempts even during this period. And in order to stop drinking, he would, we'd basically take the phone off the hook and stay shut up in the house for a week. He always seemed a different person in a way when he'd stopped drinking for a while, and then his innate sweetness would come out.
How did you and Kerouac end up breaking up?
We went out to dinner. This was in October of 1958 with a bunch of artists we knew, and right before my eyes, Jack was flirting outrageously with a woman whom I knew was very interested in him, and I could sort of see the handwriting on the wall, and I'd seen this kind of thing one too many times, and I just couldn't stand it, so I asked Jack to come outside the restaurant with me, and I told him I couldn't bear it and that it was the end. I said to him, because it was the only thing I could think of, "You're nothing but a big bag of wind."
What was his reaction when you told him you couldn't take it anymore?
He said, I told you, I don't like blondes. Unrequited love's a bore. You know, it was though we were shouting nonsense at each other. And then he stomped off into the restaurant, and I went up the block, and that was it.
So that was really it?
That was it. It ended very abruptly.
How did he describe you in Desolation Angels?
As middle class, sad, and looking for something.
He also wrote, "Perhaps the best love affair I ever had."
Right, and he said that I had me a companion there. And I think that was a very important thing to Jack, the fact that we were both writers. And a lot of the things we wrote to each other were about our writing. And this was a novelty for him, to have a woman in his life who was as interested in writing as he was.
You say in your new book that you've had to protect your memories from being swamped by Kerouac's legend. What are some parts of the legend that don't fit with your memories?
Well, the idea that Jack was such a free spirit, you know, mainly, that this big example of freedom, or this, you know, or that he was this great Buddhist, those things. Because... you know, although he certainly did go on the road, and you know, deep inside him, he wasn't free at all. He was so knotted up and so miserable and so attached to his mother. And Buddhism was something that was very important to Jack, and he it was one of those things he looked to find some solution to what troubled him, but he really misused it, even though he had a profound intellectual understanding of it. He used Buddhism to sort of rationalize all his problems and you know, what was the point of dealing with them since we're all going to die anyway?
What did you think a few years ago of the Gap campaign of, you know, Kerouac wore khakis?
One thing that amused me very much about that campaign was there was a picture of Jack wearing khakis in a photo shoot. It was an old photo that had been taken for Pageant magazine. A photographer had followed Jack and me around the village for a night, and I was airbrushed out of it as though I had never existed.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
So you saw that photo without you on
that's right.
On buses and
that's right.
Posters
that's right.
Over.
And oh, I knew really there was funny. A ghost there. Yeah.
Oh gosh. Well, that's so perfect, cuz your first book was called Minor Characters.
It's called exactly.
And
exactly.
All about how the women were relegated to the status of minor character in the yeah. Beat story. Oh, that's so funny. Joyce Johnson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Joyce Johnson's book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters she and Jack Kerouac wrote each other. The book has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded last year after it was published in hardcover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.